Our main speaker tonight is Mike.
Mike, alcoholic. It's good to be here. I'm glad I'm finally getting this over tonight. My sobriety date is January 15th, 1991. My home group is the Englewood 1215 meeting. And, you know, when I come to this meeting, I've been coming here for some time. I know a lot of people here and all. And, you know, one thing I noticed tonight when Stella was talking about the fifth tradition, really, really important. And, you know, the Atlantic group kicks it in, you know, as far as being there in primary purpose. tonight I was lectured a little bit before about cursing and the other stuff, and also, you know, I want to keep it in a real, you know, alcohol I have no problem to talk about. My story is about a raging alcoholic. You know, before anything and before I get into some of the, you know, some parts of my journey along the way, something that's really dear to my heart is the third and 11th step. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I, you know, I love it because of the 12 steps and the design for living and what these steps have done for me. And I respect Alcoholics Anonymous because of the 12 traditions and how they calmed me down when I came into this program and keep me stable for the last 25 years. My sponsor is Tony C. He's from Monmouth Junction, New Jersey. He's a saint. He's been sponsoring me over 25 years. And I drove him nuts in the beginning. You know, it was hard. You know, like I said before, you know, I want to talk a little bit before I start on the journey about the third and 11th step. I had to go into that before, 5 minutes before the meeting started. All of a sudden, I just started going into like some type of panic attack, you know. And, you know, I brought God in, and that was it. And on a daily basis, that's something that I have to do regardless, whether it's panic, anything. It's making that decision on a daily basis. Stella mentioned before about, to the newcomer, about certain things you're not going to understand, language and whatever, and, you know, I get that. And it's really important tonight to try to identify with, you know, with me as far as how I got to speak this way and how I got to understand the language and to live the language. And when I talk about that, it's really about, you know, primary purpose, and it's really about the design for living. And I got that through the work that I've done and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, being still is a very important thing in my life because, you know, I come from a background of when I call myself a raging alcoholic and a blackout alcoholic. You know, early in the book in Bill's story, and There's a Solution, we talk about the definition of what alcohol is, why of it, why the alcoholic does what he does, you know, why knowing that, you know, if I go into that bar tomorrow, or if I go into that bar tonight, you know, the girlfriend's gone, I'm evicted, I don't have the money for the rent, I lost my job because I'm not going to get there tomorrow morning, but yet alcohol had me by my grips, and that was it. I was a slave to alcohol. I was saturated with alcohol and saturated with alcoholic thinking. I really identify in the doctor's opinion when they talk about the alcoholic torture, because with me, the luxury of drinking did not, you know, it didn't hang out for a while. You know, I wasn't there, and all of a sudden, it became a necessity. It became a necessity right away, immediately. I'm a child of the late 60s. You know, I'll leave it at that, early 70s, just to, you know, just to talk a little bit about that part of my life and talk about it respectfully. You know, back then, 1969, just to give you an idea of, we were real burnouts. You know, one of my friends, Jerry's here tonight. We grew up together, and I know him since back then. And we were, you know, real hippies, real burnouts. I was introduced back then to, you know, Boone's Farm Apple Wine and Matus and Lance's and all. And it was like ketchup on French fries because it went so good with the other stuff. you know, and it was, you know, back then I had a higher power named William H. Rohrer, and, you know, I was, I was enmeshed in that world. And when I talk about burnouts, I'm talking about, like, clueless, you know, just every single day. And give you an idea of that, and 1969 Woodstock's going on. I'm 14 years old. I grew up in this town in Bergen County, Cliffside Park, and I probably have never been out of Cliffside Park. I was a 14-year-old with a curfew, you know, and I'm out there, and we're doing our thing. There's, like, eight of us in the car, and we're listening on the radio about Woodstock going on and New York Thruway's closed and Route 17, whatever. So we decide, let's take a ride up there, like if it was right in the next town, you know? And we're on Route 17 in Paramus, and there's tons of traffic. We pull over in a grassy knoll. We're hanging out there for hours. This is far out, man, you know, all this stuff, drinking, you know. We had a case of beer and whatever. And all of a sudden we leave, we go back to home. And when we get home the next day, we're telling an older brother, yeah, we were stuck in Woodstock traffic. And he's there, you know, you bunch of, so you were stuck in mall traffic in Paramus. That wasn't what, you know. And, you know, we're like, wow, man, far out, you know. And that was the lifestyle, you know. So, you know, we were burnouts, and the 70s was really a burnout time, you know. Two main pages I want to talk about. I mean, the whole book is incredible, but in page 21, when it talks about at some time in an alcoholic's career, you cross the line where you no longer have any control over it. And I did that immediately. Like I said, the luxury was gone. It was necessity. And it had me in its grips at the age of 17, early 70s. I'm lying in a gutter in town, being picked up by the cops, taken to what's called, now it's Bergen Regional, but at the time it was Bergen Pines, and detoxing there. My eyes rolled in my head, foaming at the mouth, getting my stomach pumped, you know, 151 rum inside me and other stuff and whatever. And it was the first time that I ever heard, if you keep doing this, you're going to die. And I was there several times after that, again and again and again. Because what does the alcoholic do? There's no why in it, you know. The why comes like in Bill's story when he's banging on the bar and he's saying, why the hell did I do this again, you know? And that's my story, and it went on. There's no significant bottom in my story. I do not know the date that I had my first drink. I just know that I started drinking at an early age. I was a blackout, raging alcoholic from the get-go. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, I can laugh at it now. Back then, you know, our cop cars in town at that time were green. And I remember, you know, my friend Jerry's here tonight, and he nicknamed me, if anybody remembers the show, Andy and Barney, Mayberry, whatever, he named me Otis, you know. And in that show, Otis was the town drunk. And, you know, a lot of shame and remorse in that, you know, and I'll talk to you later about that. But you know, I can laugh at that stuff now, but that's the way I walked. I didn't walk. I wobbled around town. I was stoned and hot, you know, drunk every single day that I could be. And it wasn't a buzz. Buzz is not incorporated in my lifestyle. It was stoned out, blackout. That was it. And I used to be picked up all the time, and they used to say, are you taking a green cab home tonight? And that mean the cops would pick me up, put me in a car, take me home, knock on the door, and just leave me there. No arrest, no nothing, just leave me there. And it was like a joke, you know. Fast forward years later, around 10 years ago, I go in a restaurant in town, true story, I go in a restaurant in town, and I see one of the old cops there at the bar, and I'm saying hello, and he's telling me, I'm retired on a disability pension. And I said, what happened? He goes, I got a bad back picking you up years ago. He goes to me, you should have been born with handles on. He goes, I said, all right, whatever. You know, and you laugh at that stuff now, you know. It's like looking back, like, what was I thinking? But a lot of, you know, stoned out, drunken, you know, I loved drinking. I loved what alcohol felt like. the warmness going in, and I wanted to drink every single day. That was it. So I gravitated toward jobs that had to do with alcohol, drugs, whatever. And back in the 70s, they used to call them roadies. I was, my hair was down on my back. I looked a lot different than I do now. And back then it was Paul McGregor haircuts, hip hugger pants, and the fringe boots, with the fringe jacket and the dirty red bandana, all that stuff, and we clean up good, whatever. But, I was a roadie for bands and worked in a lot of clubs in New Jersey. And then I started working in a concert hall in New Jersey called the Capitol Theater. And I used to work security for the Capitol Theater. A lot of you guys here probably know what I'm talking about. Front door security. I'm there with a beard, long hair and all. I was the guy that confiscated your drugs and alcohol before you went into the theater. I patted you down, and I got to keep it, and I got to use it. So, and it was beautiful because I had a lot of product, too, that, I'm getting paid to watch these bands, I'm getting paid to watch these bands, and the fringe benefits, forget about it. It was incredible. So it was cool. The consequences weren't that bad, getting kicked out of basement apartments every now and then. But it was fun, it was really like, it's funny, I'm at retirement age right now, and I get this Social Security statement telling me about my history. And it's funny, from 1970 to 91 I got sober, but for those years, I'm looking at some of the years, total earnings, $26, $18. I'm looking at 1979, great year, $250, I mean, that was my lifestyle. That was it. I have it. I look at that, and then of course, sobriety kicks in, and, manageability kicks in. That's why for the newcomers, when you look at that first step, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I looked at the steps, and I'm like, oh, geez, more rules and regulations, And I look at the first step, I shrugged my shoulders, and I said, I've known that for the last 22 years, and I don't care, So, excuse me. So anyhow, moving along, in the 80s, things got a lot darker, and, the drinking just continued. There was no progression in my life. Everything from the 70s and 80s was all the same. It just, I peaked at an early age, and that was it, and it continued. But by this time, I saw darkness setting in. It wasn't that fun anymore. Looking back at it right now, I had a death wish. I just really didn't want to be around anymore. I was sleeping on people's couches. I was periods of homelessness, in between apartments. Friends were always helping me out with food and borrowing money for my next one and all. And that happened for quite a few years where it was just like totally like, chaotic. And, I spoke really fluent self-pity and victimese. I was a victim and self-pity and all that. And you could always tell, at the bar, I was the type of guy that sat at the corner stool and annoyed the hell out of the bartender and said, I'm going to do that someday. I'm going to do that, you always knew when I broke up or well, I broke up. She broke up with me. You always knew when a girlfriend broke up with me because, it was probably like $10 worth of quarters in the jukebox listening to Desperado over and over again, hanging on a jukebox with the shot and all and. You know what I'm talking about, and that's exactly what my lifestyle was like. And it was nothing in my life about, there was no encouragement, there was nothing, no incentive for me to even, admit. I mean, I admitted it, but, just no incentive whatsoever to try anything to straighten my life out whatsoever. And things started getting dark. And, sometimes I call it I prostituted myself, not sexually, but I prostituted myself because I sold myself to the devil. I sold myself to drugs and alcohol. I would do insane things on alcohol. You know, I'll tell you right now, I was staring at this big book up here before and the microphone, and I'm grateful that I'm not up here saying, I swear to tell the whole truth. Not, you know, I mean, I was like staring because, thank you. I'll tell you right now, I should be dead quite a few times over or in jail for a very long time with some of the stuff that went on in my life. I was flying down to Florida at People's Express back then, drunk as a skunk, crazy, picking up goods down there, taping them to my body, coming back here, sweating profusely in Newark Airport, landing with enough contraband on me to put me away for, you know, forget about it, you know? But yet, what does the alcoholic mind do? They say, God, please, let me get over this. Let me get home safely. Let me party my ass off tonight, you know what I mean? Let me do the best I can, and I'll never do this again. And, you know, there you are at the airport the following week doing the same stuff. And like I said, darkness set in. It was insane. You know, there were rooftops in Washington Heights, guns to the head. You know, I remember running away from the cops one night down a stairwell, and I ran into a cop, and it was just me and a cop, and he had the barrel of the gun right to my forehead, and he was, like, looking at me. No words were said for, like, 8 seconds, and all of a sudden, he just said, get the F out of here. And I never thought of, you know, the consequences, like what just happened. My main worry was, hey, let's go back there again tomorrow. Looked like a lot of fun, you know. And, you know, the insanity set in. By this time, I'm working construction in the late 80s down in Hudson County. And I had a mentor, you know, what I call a street rabbi. He took a liking to me, and he... you know, he told me I was, you know, he used to say to me, you're like a son to me and all that. So I had like really, this guy was very influential. And I had really, good opportunities, I would say. And the crew I was hanging out with or associated with at the time, we got away with a lot of stuff, or they did anyway. You know, I was just hanging out and... you know, wanted to be a, we call them in New Jersey, a wannabe, you know, and I was always around, and I was like the kid I was taken care of and all, and it was cool, you know. But along the way, I don't want to get too much into the history of it, but the insanity of being home one night, it's 3 a.m, I'm drinking out of my mind in a blackout, and one of these guys knocks on my door and hands me a towel rolled up. And he says, hold on to this. I got to leave for a little while. I'll be back, you know, in a month or two. And I open up the towel, and it's the .22 Beretta, you know. So I didn't think about what just happened. Where was this? You know, I didn't think about, oh, I'm an excess. None of that. You know, I'm starting saying, oh, I start carrying the thing around, you know. And I'm carrying the thing around in blackouts where friends of mine would actually take it away from me. And, you know, I wake up the next morning saying, where is it? And they're like, we had to take it away from you because you were starting to get the look. You know, and that look is that the insane stuff. Because I love rage, you know. So we were a little nuts back then, you know. And the insanity set in. And we used to do crazy things. We used to drink all we wanted to on the job. We were down in Lincoln Harbor over here in Payne Weber and in Newport in Jersey City. And we were there for a few years building the whole thing. And we had the prime jobs. Everybody knew to leave us alone. Don't bother us. I remember one time, you know, we used to send what's called messages. And I remember one time we're up in a high rise and we're up there drinking. And everybody's supposed to get back to work. It's after lunch. And the courtyard is right below us. And the trailers are there with all the bosses. And we had this real pain in the ass super on a job who was always on a microphone yelling, screaming. And so we used to fill up a spackle bucket with like 2 inches of concrete, wet concrete, you know, weighs a little bit. And we used to wait until he went into his trailer. And then we used to throw the spackle bucket so it would splatter outside his trailer. He wouldn't come out for like 2 hours, you know what I mean? And that was just the way we lived, you know, it was just insane stuff. And, you know, there was no, along the way, the drinking was just incredible. The stuff that I was doing, it was every day was just working for the drink. And alcohol was my master. It really was. It had been for so many years, you know. And at this time, there was no significant bottom when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1991 through a rehab. I just figured, let me go in there. You know, they'll leave me alone for a little bit. And I come into AA. At this time, when I came into AA, I had a much higher profile job as a union delegate. And the grandiosity was oozing out of me, you know. And I come in here, and you guys, like we were talking about before, the language that's used, I'm like, and I'm saying to this guy, Tony, what are they talking about? You know, all this stuff. And he says, relax, just listen, keep coming back. And I had that barroom mentality, you know. I still had it in. Guys would smile at me across the table, and I'd be looking at them, what the fuck are you smiling at? You know, that whole mentality. And then, of course, what about, what did we talk about? Causes and conditions. What do we talk about? The exact nature of our wrongs in the fifth step. You know, our motives, you know. My motives were, where were the meetings with the nicer looking women and all that stuff. And, you know, some of the guys out there know exactly what I'm talking about, you know. And that infamous AA pickup line where the guy comes up to the woman after the meeting, tilts his head and goes, I really love what you shared, you know. I really identify with that, you know. And that was me, full of it, you know, that was me. I knew nothing about this God stuff, and now about sex. I go to my sponsor, what is this now? What about it? I love it, you know. And he's going, no, you got to read on. I said, why is God in the sex pages, you know? And I just drove him nuts, you know. I remember, like I said, the grandiosity, one time, I used to torture him, but one time we're in a meeting and they're talking about this group conscience stuff and the seven tradition, and I asked him, what's this seven tradition stuff? Well, it's money, you know, the group survival, this and that. And I look at him and I said, you know, I can get the group alone, you know, they'll have to pay 15% every week, but I could get, I know a guy, you know, and they're like, he's like, Mike, shut up, listen, and that was the lifestyle, you know, for a while. Untreated alcoholism, as I like to call it, you know, the early days. And, you know, I, you know, going back into that whole dating thing that I was just talking about, you know, had no steps in my life, no program whatsoever. 2 years sober, I meet this woman in AA because I said the right things. I really love what you share, you know. And, we go out on our date in May. We start living together in June. We get engaged in August. She tells me she's pregnant in February. We get married in April. My daughter's born in December. And we get separated and divorced in April. You know, 18 months. No steps in my life. My message with that is really, if you're walking around like a dead battery, please, it's so important. You know, don't do as I do. Primary purpose is not just for me to be up here and telling you about the 12 steps, which I have in my life for some time now, and doing the work with others and helping another alcoholic. Primary purpose for me is also to tell you what not to do. And that's important for me to tell my story to other people of things that you don't have to go through that misery. Because my sponsor kept saying, Mike, when the pain gets strong enough, you know, you're going to come to your knees and you're going to come, you know, because you're just barely staying sober, just going to meetings and doing a little, you know, like we call it, two-stepping and doing a little service here. I had this big car, of course, and people would ask me for rides. They would ask me for my phone number, and I would put underneath rides only. And they would ask me, what does that mean? I'd look at them and say, rides only. I don't want to talk about anything. Don't bother me about anything. You want to ride? You know, because that was my attitude. And everybody was like, leave him alone. He'll come around sooner or later. And sure enough, you know, coming around, I was handed a key to a church. I was told I was going to be the coffee maker. Service saved my life. You know, it was unbelievable. And, you know, I talked about that in the 21st page of the book, we're crossing the line and when you lose all control. But one of my favorite pages in back, page 567, the spiritual experience, where that moment comes in there. If you read that, it just talks about change constantly. The word change is all over there. Vast change, revolutionary change, transformation, overwhelming change, personality change. And the best line of that whole reading for me, a profound alteration to my reaction to life. Because my whole life, thank you, my whole life was about reacting, and my reaction was not a favorable one, not to anybody else and not to me. And that came through little stuff. Don't look for that white lightning stuff or anything. It came through little moments where all of a sudden I'm driving. The first time, I'll never forget driving, and all of a sudden I was listening to music or whatever. All of a sudden I went like this. I went, whoa. It was the first time I ever learned to go, go ahead, go. I never did that before in my life. I never went, go ahead, go. I said, this feels good. Go ahead, go. I sat there for 10 minutes, go, everybody, go. I'm sober, you know. So, you know, and like these little moments of clarity started setting in. And I was like so proud of myself because we're street guys, you know. We're street guys, we're maniacs. And, you know, and I remember another time I come out of the gym, you know, it's like 20 years ago, and I'm in a 10 items or less aisle or whatever, and I look down, I see 13 items, and I'm like, holy shit. So I look back, and there's a little old lady, somebody behind them. So I go, the guilt, that emotional hangover starts climbing, you know, and it starts eating at me, and I'm like, once again, you're getting over, you know. And I asked the lady, I said, can you do me a favor? I just got to get out. I got to go into this. And she's like, don't worry about it. I said, lady, I got to do this, you know what I mean? And I got out of. And these were the little things that really, I was proud of myself, you know? I was really proud that these profound alterations to my reaction to life set in. You know, I've been off to the races ever since. I sponsor 5 men in my life. They've been through the big book with me. I'm always taking somebody through our work. You better come ready with your book, your highlighter, your pad. You better be ready to listen. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit before we end about sponsorship and how important it is because of primary purpose and how some of us have to be patient with others. One of my favorite sponsorship stories, and I got many, but I get a lot of hard guys, hardcore guys, and I'll keep his name at Rob. I'll call him Rob tonight. And now, you know... Rob is a muscular tattooed guy out of jail, straight out of the system, and all of a sudden I'm his sponsor, and nobody would sit next to Rob. He was just this guy, like, you know, and very, you know, very crazy psycho past in his life. I take him under my wings, and we're going through the big book. Now, the only job Rob could get is as a waiter. And it was funny because every week he'd have a different job because, of course, you know, you give him a hard time. It's like, you know. Anyway, he comes to me one day. We're going to go through the book, and he says to me, listen, I'm having a tough time at work with my boss and blah, blah, blah. I said, sit down, relax. Listen, I read for 45 minutes. I'm making comments. At the end of the reading, he didn't listen to a word I said. He said to me, you think it'd be wrong if I go to work tonight and just choke the whatever out of my boss. I said, Rob, we don't do that anymore. I said, we used to, no more. And we talked him out of it, whatever. I get a phone call the next day, and he said to me, you'd be proud of me. I said, what happened? He goes, he aggravated me, he belittled me, but I didn't touch him. I asked him to see him in his office. And when we went in the office, I locked the door behind me, and he looked at me, and he says, you're not going to hit me, are you? I said, no. I locked him in the closet. I took my apron off and I quit. Are you proud of me? I said, I'm proud of you, man. You know, I love you. And you know, Rob, 8 years later, Rob is an alcohol and drug counselor. 2 days ago, Rob called me up and asked me some questions about the 10th step. And I asked him, I said, are you okay? He goes, I have to give a lecture to some officials from New Jersey because I'm being certified as a conflict resolution therapist. I'm like, you know. So now I only got a little bit left, and I just want to mention, you know, talk about my daughter, who's the love of my life, who was born in this program, you know, and through the years she was really cute and doing AA and everything. And around 3 years ago, she fell into this, the grips of this disease. It was my darkest hour, and she knew Daddy was around to talk to her. I would sit and talk to her. I knew that I couldn't force it on her, you know, and at the end of this month, I'm going down to Florida to give her a two-year coin. I'm very proud of that, you know. I love it, you know. You know, and I have to tell everybody here, it's God in AA. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really want to thank you guys for having me here tonight. Thank you.